Good morning and welcome to the Ninth Circuit. We have only one case on the calendar this morning, and that is Stanley v. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Chappelle. A capital case, 30 minutes per side, when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Joseph Schlesinger, here to represent Gerald Frank Stanley, the petitioner in this matter. When this matter was remanded to state court 6 years ago with a conditional writ of habeas corpus, district court did that with a fair amount of trepidation. The court wrote that it's nearly not possible to think that a meaningful retrospective determination could be made. It noted in particular how problematic it might be to hear from Mr. Stanley at all in state court. Little did the court know that Mr. Stanley would be the only live witness at that hearing, and most of what he would testify to was that the relief that was granted was based on a fraud upon the court. 2 years ago, after that hearing...
Can I stop you right there? I don't think it's directly in front of us, but as I look at what the Lake County Superior Court did, there was argument to him that there had been a fraud upon the court. But that's not what the court concluded. The court concluded that he was competent.
The court did conclude he was competent.
And so why do you say he concluded he was competent based upon fraud upon the court?
There was testimony. It wasn't just argument. And the court said he was taking that specific testimony into consideration. I don't mean to say that that was the only evidence. He reviewed certain transcripts and whatnot.
Okay.
And I'd spend more time on it.
It's really off to one side. Okay.
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, but just to set the framework, 2 years ago in district court after the proceedings were concluded, we filed a list of 9 reasons we felt that the hearing was not adequate to satisfy the conditions of the conditional writ. Nothing on that list sought to vacate the finding, sought to set it aside, sought to hold it unconstitutional, and we certainly weren't asking that the state court be ordered to, via a conditional writ, to hold another hearing.
But isn't that a due process argument, Mr. Schlesinger? I mean, you're saying that it was not a constitutional challenge, but it has to be a procedural challenge, is it not? Which implicates notions of due process.
We think the deficiencies were so egregious that it certainly could be couched as a due process violation.
Well, if that's the case, then why is this situation any different from the issuance of a conditional writ of habeas corpus by a federal court that is then dependent upon the state either releasing the petitioner or granting him some kind of a new trial or new proceeding, which then works its way back up through the state courts and eventually results in the filing of a new federal habeas petition, raising whatever the new constitutional challenges might be to what happened on remand?
A couple of reasons, Your Honor. First, although I said the issues could rise to the level of a due process violation, they don't need to rise to that level. And determining whether the finding is meaningful, as this court did in McMurtry versus Ryan a number of years ago, doesn't require finding a due process violation. In McMurtry, which I assume two members of the panel are far more familiar with than I am, but the court reviewed the evidence at the hearing. There were no claims of constitutional violations. The court simply concluded that the evidence wasn't sufficient to make a meaningful determination of the petitioner's competency. But beyond that, Your Honor, the main reason it's different is Pate v. Robinson claims are different from other types of claims. Pate makes clear that the decision is a snapshot of the defendant's functioning at a moment of time, and he's entitled to a contemporaneous finding. Nothing we ever do after that can put him back in exactly the same procedural posture. So what Pate requires the courts to do is, before they think about sending it back for that type of conditional writ. There has to be some reasonable likelihood that the finding might be reliable.
But why wouldn't you make this argument to either the District Court of Appeal, or maybe because it's a capital case, file an appeal directly with the California Supreme Court challenging what happened in Lake County?
Well, frankly, we don't know if they would entertain that. And I say that at the same time, I don't know that they wouldn't entertain it. But comity and finality.
So why wouldn't they entertain it?
Because it's not a judgment, so we don't think we can file a habeas petition in state court. The reason we can pursue the claim in federal court is we have a petition granted in our favor, and we are dealing with the remedy for that. We simply want to expand the remedy. State court, a competency finding, whether it's retrospective or contemporaneous, isn't a judgment, and state court has the same restrictions, or the state of California has the same restrictions on habeas petitions that the federal court does. You have to be attacking a judgment. In state court, a competency proceeding is a special proceeding. It's not, doesn't result in a criminal judgment. And if the state thought that this had been a judgment, as the state is arguing here, he would have been entitled to an automatic appeal that would have been docketed for him in the California Supreme Court. But no such appeal was docketed. State court's understanding is they were making a report to the federal court, not issuing a judgment, but a finding that would pretermit any further grant of relief in federal court. And that was our understanding as well.
Assuming for a moment that you're wrong, and I don't know. I mean, there's this question of state law, and there may be some difficulties. But just assume for the moment that an appeal would be possible in the state court system from the determination by the state court in Lake County that he was competent at that time. You mentioned the possibility of an automatic appeal because it's a capital case. Do we even know that it would have been an automatic appeal? And had it been an automatic appeal, would it necessarily have gone straight from the Superior Court to the California Supreme Court, as an ordinary capital appeal does? I mean, the complications just keep tumbling in here. And then I've got one last question. If there's not an automatic appeal, would there be a requirement to take a timely appeal? And has that time now passed, making the appeal impossible? I mean, I realize that's a whole series of questions.
But I think I can pull apart some of them, and if I miss some of them, please let me know. The order was probably appealable. California law is post-judgment orders are appealable if they affect substantial rights of the defendant. I think it would be pretty hard to say that this doesn't affect substantial rights. So although there's no case law I'm aware of saying this type of order is appealable, it probably falls within the statute. Automatic appeals always go to the California Supreme Court. I think probably it didn't fall within the court's understanding, and the court was aware of this case, by the way, the court's understanding of automatic appeals, because the statute says a judgment imposing a death sentence gets appealed automatically. Didn't purport to impose a death sentence. I think we're sort of saying that maybe in effect it did, but by its own terms it didn't.
But the question really, I guess, is what was the effect of the ruling by the Lake County Superior Court? Is it a final order for purposes of triggering a right to appeal? And I think, based on what you just said, it probably is. It may not be treated as an automatic appeal akin to a judgment of death, but I'd be very surprised if there were no appellate remedies available.
No, I suspect there probably was an opportunity to file a timely appeal to the Third District Court of Appeal.
Yeah.
But I think coming back to your question, Judge Tallman, why shouldn't we then just require the petitioner to go through all that? I think we have to bear in mind a couple of things. One is there was no requirement to send this back to state court at all. The case law is clear. The federal district court could have held that a competency proceeding wouldn't be feasible or could have done the competency hearing itself. So the notion, sort of in for a penny, in for a pound, although it didn't have to send it back to state court, once it did that, the petitioner then has to go through years of litigation, which we were trying to avoid 6 years ago. We said this would go much faster if we just dealt with it in federal court. But it's been 6 years and counting, and many more years, we think just doesn't strike the proper balance between federalism and finality and comity. Comity is a two-way street, and the state court really showed no deference to the federal court order.
Well, we don't have the authority. You had argued earlier that this was akin to the appointment of a special master. We don't have that authority to designate a state superior court judge as the California Supreme Court can do in a habeas proceeding if it needs an evidentiary record developed. What we did was we sent it back to the federal district court, and then as you've represented, the federal district court issued a conditional writ and sent it to the state court saying either let them go or determine whether you can conduct a retrospective feasibility, and if so, what's your answer? And it appears to me that's what happened.
If I implied something about special master today, I misspoke. I don't think I said that in the briefs. I know the state said that that's what we were saying. But I agree, it's a conditional writ. I think really what the crux of the problem is what was the condition? Was it hold a hearing if feasible, and it's done so, and as the state says, that's we're often running on a blank slate, or was it hold a meaningful hearing? And I think 40 years of case law from this court says the requirement is a meaningful hearing. We have sealing versus...
But why can't we reach that issue by letting the California appellate remedies run their course? I mean, it may well be that at this point in time, it's too late for Mr. Stanley to pursue further appellate remedies in state court. But he's got to try, and he's got to get a denial or dismissal from a California appellate court, which may be on the grounds that he's time barred. I don't know. But they've surprised us before, since they don't have an AEDPA 365-day rule. They might take it, in which case they might grant him the relief that he seeks, or they might say no, and at that point he can come back to the Eastern District of California and say, okay, I've exhausted, I've taken this thing as far as I can go, and now because the State Court of Appeals won't do anything about it, you, Federal District Court, are going to have to make the call.
I hear what Your Honor is saying, and if I can sort of rephrase the question, because I've thought about this a little bit, is why would it be inconsistent with the notion of retaining jurisdiction, which all these cases say we do, to say, well, we're retaining it, we're just going to exercise it after a full round of litigation in state court? And I think the answer to that is it's really the antithesis of retaining jurisdiction to say this is a new claim attacking a new judgment, has to be challenged with a new set of habeas claims, which is what the magistrate judge said eventually. Because then we're no longer retaining jurisdiction. We're just saying, go live your life, file another habeas petition when the time is right. That's not retaining
jurisdiction. But I know you don't want to characterize it as a constitutional due process challenge, but it sounds to me like you do have at least some new constitutional claims arising from what happened in the California courts, which would then be treated just like any other errors that occurred after a conditional writ issued, and it seems to me there'd be right to another round of federal habeas review raising those new claims.
Well, part of what I have to respectfully take issue with is not just like any other kind of conditional writ, because all other kinds of conditional writs that I can think of, retry or release, are starting from square one. They're getting a new judgment. There's no retention over the meaningfulness. And that's what we asked for in this case. Had we gotten the relief we wanted.
Would that be true on a Martinez remand? In other words, suppose that we send a matter back to the state courts in order to make the record on a Martinez IAC claim, and the state court holds whatever evidentiary hearing they hold and concludes that there was no ineffective assistance.
Well, there's holding from this court, and I don't have the case site in front of me, that Martinez issues don't have to be exhausted. So if we want to talk about that line of cases, I think it actually supports our position, because you could get into an infinite loop if you're saying any type of challenge in the federal habeas proceeding has to be sent back to state court for a first look. Then when it comes back and there's a challenge to what the state court did, then we have to exhaust that and just keep going around and
but
around.
But didn't the district court essentially engage in a stay and abate decision here in the manner in which?
Absolutely. They said we're going to.
Which is what the Supreme Court has told district courts they should do if they're unexhausted
claims. If there are new claims.
Right.
And that's how Judge Hollows got to that conclusion.
Yeah.
I think you're raising claims. They need to be exhausted. I'm going to deem your status report as complying with AEDPA, and now I'm holding it in abeyance. But that presupposes what we're trying to determine, whether these are claims or not. And the fact that the hearing was so bad that there were arguably new constitutional violations, I don't think changes the character. Some of the things we're alleging were wrong with the hearing aren't independent violations. We say the Butte County Court found it would be feasible to hold a hearing because trial counsel Peterson and Blake and the experts were available to testify. Then they have a hearing and none of those people testify.
The fact that they didn't testify doesn't mean that in Lake County, doesn't mean that Butte County was wrong in its assessment as to whether they were available.
No, he said it's feasible if you do it a certain way, and then they do it a different way. In essence, it was reconsideration of the feasibility. The state says, well, here's why it's feasible. This person, that person, the other person are available to testify. Then it goes to another county, and then they say, well, we don't want to call any of those people.
Another county and another lawyer.
In another district, by the way. So we still have the problem of, if we're filing a new petition, are we moving to the northern district?
Another question, but again, this is, in a sense, still off to one side of what the question is in front of us. Am I right in assuming that if exhaustion goes forward in the state court with an appeal, for example, from the Lake County Superior Court, that it would be Mr. Levitt who would represent him?
Well, since one of the issues raised is that Mr. Levitt perfetrated a fraud on the court, the Lake County Superior Court, I think he'd be very hard-pressed to be able to represent him in that proceeding.
But your jurisdiction won't allow you to appear in state court, is that correct?
No, we can get authorization from the presiding judicial officer in the federal habeas proceeding to do an ancillary matter in state court.
So your representation of him can continue in state court?
Yes, I told you.
So if we decided this had to be exhausted, you could take his appeal in California?
What I told Mr. Stanley yesterday was, if we lose this appeal, I will be filing a writ of habeas corpus in state court, challenging the finding. I don't know what will happen. It's very possible the court will say we don't have jurisdiction, is essentially what you're saying.
Do you have to file a writ of habeas corpus in state court? You can't file a direct appeal?
Well, I think the time is up for filing an appeal. I think part of the writ would include
the IAC
challenging
claim.
The decision not to file the appeal
right.
in a timely fashion.
Okay. Well, now that we've taken almost 20 minutes on issues that are off to one side, why do we have appellate jurisdiction over this order?
Well, I think the primary reason is it's essentially the refusal to allow the filing of a 60B motion. It came up in kind of a strange way because we were told to go to exhaust before we actually filed our motion. But the case law is that the way to enforce a conditional writ is under Rule 60B. The Thompson versus Calderon case from this court in about 98, I think, says if a court refuses to entertain a 60B motion in a habeas case and tells you to go do something else instead, that's appealable. So that, I think, is the primary basis. The notion that it's interlocutory and all those things sort of leave out of the equation that there is a final judgment on this claim already. We're seeking to reopen that judgment. It's not your garden variety stay abeyance pre-hearing posture. So I think the 60B is the...
How can that... But you characterized it as a conditional writ. Isn't the conditional writ a judgment?
Yes. I'm sorry if I misspoke, Your Honor. There was a final judgment. It was entered pursuant to Civil 52B, I think, the partial entry of judgment. All of the other claims regarding the penalty phase and whatnot were held in abeyance to see what happened in state court, and they will pick up at some point, regardless of what happens to this claim. So it's a post-judgment motion on that judgment. We're seeking to modify that judgment. The judgment was the state court should do a determination, if feasible. Our motion is... Turned out it wasn't feasible to do a reasonable job on this, so just issue the other part of the conditional writ and vacate the death judgment. Have I answered your question, Your Honor? You look
well, I mean, this is a really difficult procedural case, and I hear what you just said, and I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but... Isn't that true every time the district court stays and abates?
There's no judgment, typically, because
that's
really
true.
Hasn't
reached the merits yet of the federal issues.
It usually comes in with the initial petition. It's a mixed petition.
Right.
The whole case is held in abeyance.
But let's take another analogy then. Suppose, forget about Mr. Stanley, let's suppose that we... reverse a district court's denial of habeas relief and direct it to issue a conditional writ and remand the case to the state court. There would be a judgment to that effect entered in that case, but that would not be appealable at that point, would it not? Because we'd have to wait and see what happened after the conditional writ was issued in the state court.
I'm sorry, I think I got a little lost, Your Honor. Was there a judgment granting the writ in the hypo?
No, a judgment denying habeas relief in the district court comes up to the Ninth Circuit. We reverse and remand, directing the district court. Wouldn't it do just exactly the same thing? It would issue a new judgment that essentially vacates the prior judgment denying relief and issues a conditional writ judgment sending the case back to the state courts, either release them or retry them. And that decision would not be appealable again at that point, would it?
Well, the petitioner wouldn't be aggrieved by that grant of the writ, so appealable by the state, not sure. I guess it would be law of the case.
The problem I'm having in trying to see that this order is appealable now is we already addressed, the last time this matter was in front of us, the deficiency with regard to the competency issue.
Correct.
On which Judge Damrell had granted habeas relief.
Actually, that wasn't appealed, but yes, we certainly were talking about that because we appealed the limitation on the remedy.
Yeah. And we reversed and remanded, which had the effect of directing the district court to vacate that judgment and issue a conditional writ,
With apologies, Your Honor, it affirmed the conditional writ. This court affirmed exactly what
that's
the
right.
district court
That's did. Right. Okay, so affirming it but directing that further proceedings be conducted on the competency issue.
The court was going to do that already. The court had said, we're going to follow Odal in this case, send it back to state court.
Right.
I was here 4 years ago saying, I don't think it's going to be meaningful.
Yeah.
And the court said, well, let's leave that to the state court. And, you know, here we are saying it wasn't meaningful.
Now, I don't attach any fault to anybody on this, and it might just be my lack of awareness, but I do not recollect when you were here before knowing that the proceedings in the state court were already underway at the time we were entertaining that appeal.
The court asked for a supplemental briefing regarding the status and some other things about Mr. Stanley's filings. Both parties responded to that. It informed the court that the proceedings hadn't started yet. I recall going painfully through each hearing that had happened so far and describing to the court what had happened at each hearing. And I think we were up to about 11 hearings at that time, and it was all Mr. Levitt wanted to be appointed. The court saying, no, you were barred from this case.
I see. So it was all, as it were, just kind of throat clearing still.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I see I'm getting close to the end of the time. I only addressed one of the three grounds that...
Well, we're not going to be terribly strict. If we have things to say, you have things to say. Let me ask, although you've been kind of addressing it, and don't worry about it. If your time runs, we'll give you a chance to respond. I'm unclear on, assuming we have jurisdiction on appeal, I'm unclear why exhaustion should or should not be required. Can you help me out on this? I mean, it's been briefed and so on, but if you could help me just in oral communication, yeah, why the ordinary exhaustion should apply here in this rather unusual circumstance.
I feel your pain, Your Honor, because there's a dearth of directly applicable authority. Mr. Witt found an out-of-circuit case that's unpublished that says exhaustion's required in a footnote, and I was able to find no cases on it either way other than that. Where the remand had been a result of federal court action, and in fact, in the Reed versus Champion case, it wasn't even a result of federal action. But I think the answer to it, and that's why I've spent so much time on, is it a judgment, is it a claim, is it an argument, because that follows. It's only claims attacking judgments that need to be exhausted under the habeas statute, and it follows from it's not a claim, it's an argument, this isn't a judgment, it's a finding, therefore it's not a claim attacking the judgment that needs to be exhausted.
Okay. Maybe time to hear from the state, and then we'll give you a chance to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jesse Witt, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent appellee, the warden. Taking Your Honor's last question, why should this claim be exhausted? I'm not fully conversant with the space-time continuum, but contrary to the position the federal defender takes, a 1995 petition challenging the 1983 competence hearing cannot exhaust any claims that arise out of 2011 1368 competency claim. And we have to address why is the federal defender bringing this? Well, the reason is the federal defender did not like the actions the petitioner took in the state court. It was a meaningful hearing. He had a right to a jury trial. He chose to give that right up. He had a right to present any evidence he chose. He stipulated the evidence that the Superior Court heard. He had a right to an attorney. His first attorney was removed, and he got the attorney he wanted. So the meaningfulness of the adversary process was achieved. The federal defender does not like the results of that hearing.
Counsel, given the whole question about the competency of Mr. Stanley in 1983, doesn't the bizarre nature of this proceeding in Lake County raise a question as to whether Stanley was competent when that hearing was held in order to waive all of those things and to testify as to his competence in 1983? So we have to have there is some evidence, there's maybe some evidentiary value in having Mr. Stanley come forward and testify that he thought he was competent in 1983, but only if we're confident of his competence in whatever the date that was, 2011 or 2012.
Well, I'll take exception to the court can use whatever it wants. Bizarre is sort of a pejorative term, but a lot of what the state proceedings were not even involved with competency. There were a change of venue with the attorneys coming up, getting conversant with the record. But Mr. Stanley was found competent by the district court post-1995 because there was some issue at that time whether the federal defender thought he was competent or not, and that was resolved. There is no challenge to Mr. Stanley's competency in the present day. No one's ever raised that issue.
Well, Mr. Levitt seems to have an interest in not challenging that.
Yes. Mr. Levitt is an old-school attorney. He represents his client's wishes. Mr. Stanley has never wanted to be found competent. Incompetent. He did not want to be found incompetent in 1983. He did not like the challenges raising his competency in the Supreme Court, in the District Court, in this Court. He does not want to be found incompetent. He has always maintained that position. That was the focus of how the competency hearing arose.
Yeah, let me reinforce Judge Bybee's question. As you probably are aware, we receive fairly regular correspondence from Mr. Stanley. And I'm not now saying that he's competent or incompetent for purposes of expressing his opinions or to be tried and so on, but he behaves in bizarre ways. And if the question were to me, do I think he's competent now, or was he competent a year or so ago to testify as to his competence in an earlier time, I'd say, you know, based on what I see in front of me, that's an issue. It does not strike me as frivolous to raise the question, was he competent in Lake County in this recent proceeding to testify as to his competence 30 years before?
Well, he would have had that, he had that opportunity, and we were here a few years ago, and I told the court the best way to resolve this is that I go back and the federal defender go back and it would have resolved in 6 months. The federal defender could have chose to have the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeal or the Superior Court appoint them to represent Mr. Stanley. They could have done it that way. They did not choose that. It was done a different way. And if there's a doubt as to Mr. Stanley's competence, I think this court has the power to hold a hearing. I was not privy to the court's hearing where they asked the federal defender to respond to his letter. I think Mr. Stanley is erroneous. I don't know if he's irrational, so maybe I just see him differently.
What's strange about this is that we, along with the district court, have been put to a lot of trouble to try to figure out whether he was competent in 1983. And that seemed to be his position in federal court was that he had never been afforded that hearing, and that was the whole basis for his federal habeas action. And you get back to state court and he waives everything. That doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well,
and the only thing that seems to be explained is the change in counsel. It's not clear that it's a change in mind on Mr. Stanley's part because nobody's really sure what Stanley thinks. But it's clear that we had a change in counsel who has a very different philosophy, and now we're back here not knowing what or who to believe.
Well, there is a house divided. The federal defender position is contrary to the client's position. You notice they wait to the second page of their opening brief before they attack their client, Mr. Stanley. Mr. Stanley did have a hearing in 1983. That was set aside not because there was a dearth of evidence on the competency issue or whether there was even any evidence that he was incompetent. It was set aside because of juror misconduct. So he had the full hearing then. It was set aside for the constitutional violation of the juror. It had nothing to do with the evidence. And the evidence is overwhelming, I think, that he's competent if the court wants to look at the record regarding that issue. But so the claim has to be exhausted. And, again, all they had to do to exhaust the claim was file a notice of appeal in the Court of Appeal. They never even filed a notice of appeal. And that's because Mr. Stanley did not want to challenge the finding. He was very happy with the finding that he was competent. The federal defender is upset with that because it removes the issue. So the state court has made a factual finding. The district court now takes that factual finding he was competent in 1983 and can resume what they've set aside. Was he later incompetent during the penalty phase? And that's a key issue because according to state law, they would have to show the change of circumstance in Mr. Stanley's behavior in order to find, for the judge to have a doubt or the attorneys raise a doubt whether he was incompetent at the time of the penalty phase, which is one of the issues remaining in the district court. So I think they, and also another thing, why would they not go to the Court of Appeal? A lot of the issues they're raising here as far as the trustworthiness of the evidence, those are evidentiary issues. Those are mostly state issues. Estelle v. McGuire, the federal courts don't even get involved in evidentiary issues at the trial level. So why is the petitioner abandoning his own state remedies by coming directly to the federal court? He is at no prejudice by his requirement that he go to the Court of Appeal and then ultimately the California Supreme Court.
Here's a question for you, and it's more a strategy question than a law question at the moment. I mean, if you're really interested in getting on with it, if the state really wants to move this along so that it has the possibility of executing Mr. Stanley rather than having die of natural causes, he's 68 years old now, is this? 65.
Yes. He's been in bad health for at least the last 7 or 8 years.
So he's old and sick. If you really want to execute him rather than just let him die of natural causes, it occurs to me one of the ways you could get on with this is to waive the exhaustion requirement. Why don't you want to do that?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, you could, right? I mean, if you waived exhaustion, we could be right. We could move. We could get on with this question.
As all your questions are, that's an excellent question, because 3 years ago, the district court is before the November plebiscite on whether we retain the thing, and the district court, I think, was attempting to stall out. I have no ill feelings going to Judge Howells, but the question was not whether the claim has been exhausted in this case, but sort of a theoretical question, do you have to exhaust this claim?
Right, and you can allow us to pretermit the question,
yes,
if you were just to waive exhaustion.
I believe that all claims have been procedurally defaulted because there was no contemporaneous objection. I would be happy to go into district court, lift the stay, let's argue in district court, and they're going to have, and the claim will be dismissed because failure to exhaust, failure to file procedural default. I will win if I get into court. I want to get into court, Your Honor. If there's a way to get into court, they raised this appeal, and that's delayed it 3 years, in which I claim is a non-appealable order. If we were still in district court, this would have been settled, and that's it. I have never taken the strategy. I've never been asked to waive exhaustion.
You're talking too fast, and I can't understand you. Tell me again what you have done or might do with respect to waiving the exhaustion requirement.
That's never been an issue, Your Honor. The issue was the theoretical, do they have to exhaust? It was not whether they've exhausted in this case, whether we agree to waive.
Yeah, but you're not
exhaustion.
Understanding my question.
Yes.
I understand that it's an issue whether they have to exhaust.
Yes.
You could allow everybody to get past that issue if you were to say whether or not he's required to exhaust, we waive any exhaustion requirement that might exist. And my question to you is, why don't you say that to the district court?
We were never in the district court with that opportunity, Your Honor. The district court issued its ruling that exhaustion was required, then they filed a notice of appeal. We have not returned to the district court subsequent to that.
But wait a minute. Before the district court issues its order saying that exhaustion is required, did you file any papers in the district court on the question as to whether exhaustion was required?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
So you could have, at that time, said whether or not it's required, we waive any exhaustion requirement. It's not that you had no opportunity. You did not say that. Now, and I'm not telling you what you have to do, but I'm asking you, why don't you want to just get on with it?
Well, Your Honor, I will try to slow down. I thought at the time the quickest way to do this was to claim they haven't exhausted, let's get on with the issue. If I thought that it was going to take 3 years to resolve an appeal from a non-appealable order, I may have considered that. The question is, I've always tried to do this the most expedient way. I thought the most expedient way was to say, you haven't exhausted, therefore there's no more state remedies, let's go on with this.
But if you say you haven't exhausted and you're required to exhaust, that means they can't bring it up in federal court, correct?
They can't contest the finding that Mr. Stan was incompetent in 1983 based on the Butte County finding that he was competent in 1983.
Right.
And we proceed from there.
Right. So exhaustion, but as we now stand, if we were to say we do not have appellate jurisdiction at this time, which I think is a distinct possibility, I assume you guys are going to be off there in state court for a while.
They can initiate state court proceedings. They've 3 years, they haven't made an attempt. They can file a notice of appeal. California is very liberal on the default for failing to file a timeliness appeal. I don't know if they're going to excuse a 3 or 4 year delay when they've had notice of it. They can file a petition for writ of habeas corpus based on ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to file a notice of appeal. I think all these things will prevail, because Mr. Stanley got what he wanted. His attorney did what Mr. Stanley wanted. There's no IC claim. There's no evidentiary claim because he agreed to the evidence that came in. All the 9 reasons they list for why this is not a meaningful hearing, he was provided the opportunity. Their claim is against Mr. Stanley. It's not against the courts of California. It's not against the prosecutor. It's not against the warden. They just don't like what the state petitioner did. And if there's a remedy for that, I haven't seen it, but that's what they'll have to pursue.
What do you make of the argument based on Thompson versus Calderon as to why we have appellate jurisdiction? I confess I don't understand the argument myself very well. It's a single paragraph in the reply brief.
I don't think so. It's not a final order because it doesn't dispose of everything, Your Honor. It's inherent in what the court will have to do later on, finding the penalty phase, but this doesn't relieve the district court of anything, so I just don't see it as final order. And then I don't see it comes under the mandamus position because he had a right to go back to the state court. He's not going to be prejudiced. They're claiming, I think, in subsequent filing that the delay somehow prejudiced them. Mr. Stanley is confined to San Quentin prison, and his LWOP has already been affirmed by this court. He's not getting out. I don't see how delay prejudices him unless he wants a speedier execution, and in that sense it would prejudice him. But under the federal defender's argument that he wants relief by having this set aside, he's not prejudiced by any delays. I just don't see why this would become an appealable order. I don't know if I'm not as conversant with Thomas B. Calderon as I should be, but I just don't see this coming in any exception that it's an appealable order. I'm prepared to submit on brief unless the court has any questions. I understand it's an unusual case, but it's an unusual case only because it is being won by the federal defender. They're dissatisfied with what Mr. Stanley did below. They could have represented Mr. Stanley below if they didn't like what was going on down there. They could have filed a notice of appeal right after the conviction, taken up the court of appeal, made all the claims that they're making now in addition to state remedy claims in the court of appeal. They have chosen not to do that. I think their position is that we don't want Mr. Stanley executed. And a way to accomplish that is by bringing up lawful procedural delays, such as this attempted appeal. And that's contrary to the position Mr. Stanley has now. Whether Mr. Stanley is rational or not, I don't know. Mr. Stanley before has volunteered to be executed. First time I met him a long time ago in Marin County, and then he changed his mind. He may change his mind again. So I'm not counting on Mr. Stanley's volunteering to do this. But as the court would point out, this case has been going on a long time. The state would like to try to attempt to enforce the judgment rendered by the people. I believe it is important. I'm not using a Nuremberg defense or a just following orders defense. I think this is the right thing to do, is to execute Mr. Stanley in this case, to take his life. And we would attempt to do that. So thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Schlesinger.
Well, as tempting as it might be to start with some of the criticism of our office, I think when the presiding judge says he doesn't understand one of my arguments, I better start there.
You didn't spend a lot of time on the argument. I went back and reread it. It shows up on page whatever it is, 4 of your reply brief. It's a single paragraph. I don't get it.
Well, and I apologize for that, Your Honor. At the time I wrote the brief, I was a little more focused on the Moses H. Cone doctrine and the collateral order doctrine, which we haven't spent much time on. But sticking with the 60B for a moment, Gonzalez versus Crosby, the U.S. Supreme Court case, also says the denial of a 60B motion in a habeas is an appealable order as a post-judgment order. You know, admittedly, part of the reason it doesn't seem to fit terribly well here is we don't actually have an order denying the 60B. As Judge Hollows noted in one of his findings and recommendations, he brought up the exhaustion issue sua sponte. So it all got litigated in terms of, as Mr. Witt says, an abstract issue of exhaustion rather than we have a motion, here's the ruling on the motion, it's denied because you need to exhaust. But that's essentially what happened. And it's clear if we had gone ahead and filed the 60B motion, you would have said, I just told you, you have to exhaust first, your motion's denied. But the Moses H. Cone and...
To be clear, you never actually did file a 60B motion?
No, we came in with a status report. We identified these problems with the proceeding. Judge Hollow said, well, I think there's an exhaustion issue here. Brief that. Both sides briefed it, and then we got an order staying and obeying the proceeding and holding that exhaustion.
So let me make sure. I think I want to ask yes or no questions. So
yes.
Did you file a 60B motion?
No.
So you have no denial of a 60B motion?
Correct.
Yet you're asking us to treat this as if it were an appeal from a denial of a motion you did not make?
That is one of the theories.
Okay,
yes, Your Honor, because it would be futile.
I think there's a reason why I didn't understand your argument. I got it. Okay.
Well, I think you understand it better. I'm not sure I benefit from that additional understanding.
We appreciate your candor.
So the Cohen Doctrine and the Moses H. Cohen Doctrine allow for appeals from delay. And the complaint is the delay. Mr. Witt says, well, it sort of benefits him because he has a stay of the execution and there's no prejudice. Well, it's legal inability to challenge the delay on a later appeal, not the subjective desire for delay or not that goes into the Cohen Doctrine. I'd like to get back to a couple of things, and I will avoid taking up too much of the Court's time, as to the merits issue or the exhaustion issue. If I heard correctly, the State's saying they're willing to waive exhaustion and to the extent
well,
they're
not. The State can say what it says. I'm not sure I heard them say that. But
well,
they said they might have been. We didn't have an opportunity to. I mean, I'm not quite sure I understood their position.
If they're willing to do that now, we would take it. I think part of what they're saying is maybe there is no remedy because the State thinks all the opportunities to present the claims or issues or whatever we're going to call them have been defaulted. We're also content to deal with that. We think we have very strong cause and prejudice.
Mr. Schlesinger, I don't mean to try and mediate this issue, but let me just throw this suggestion out. If the State is willing to get to the merits in district court, and that's what you're asking us to do, but we are reluctant because we're not even sure we have jurisdiction to do it, why couldn't you just stipulate to the dismissal of this interlocutory appeal contingent on the State agreeing to go back to the district court and reopen this thing so that all the arguments that you want to make can be heard by the district court?
Until hearing what I think I heard this morning, and Judge Fletcher is indicating maybe I didn't hear correctly.
Well, I'm not sure what I heard or what you heard.
Okay. I had no idea that the State might be thinking about waiving exhaustion, and I am more than happy to talk to Mr. Witt about whether we can resolve the appeal and some of the procedural difficulties in district court via stipulation.
Well, I mean, it just seems to me that and I haven't obviously had a chance to discuss this with my colleagues, but it just seems to me that if there's a serious question here as to whether we can entertain this appeal at all, and if we were to dismiss this appeal or you somehow lose it, you're going to end up back somewhere, either in the district court or before the California courts. So if you could agree to whatever it is that you're going to do from this point forward, that might avoid the issue that we're wrestling with.
I am sure we will talk about that, and if the court would like us to report back on those discussions before more effort goes into trying to figure out what I said in the briefs, that would be.
Well, you know, what we might do, and we often do in cases where mediation appears that it may help, is that we issue an order asking our mediation unit to contact the both of you to see whether mediation is possible, report back to us whether mediation is possible. As I'm sure you know, what the mediators do with you stays there. We have no, it's a black box. They say mediation is possible, not possible. If it goes to mediation, mediation worked or didn't work, and then they report back. And as I hear you, you think the mediation, at least for the purposes of deciding whether or not to dismiss this appeal, might be useful. Mr. Witt, would mediation be fruitful?
Your Honor, I question what the authority has. I don't know if I state my position clearly. I think the exhaustion claim, we've won that. They haven't exhausted that. Any additional claim the accused raised would be dismissed. They said they've already made the claim challenging. I don't have a problem with the merits on that because the court will find that they have it and that can be dismissed. So I don't know if I can directly answer your question. I'm not opposed to it. If the court wants to issue that order, and I can talk with my superiors in the Attorney General's office and you can talk to the federal government. I would appreciate any
Okay. So it sounds as though it might be useful. Yeah.
Counsel, is there any advantage to you to attempting to go through the California system and perhaps having the California courts tell you that that you don't have a right to exhaust anymore, that your time is gone, because then you can now raise the cause and prejudice? Part of the problem here is the disconnect between what Stanley's counsel argued in federal court and what Stanley's counsel has argued in state court. And it looks like Mr. Levitt sort of gave the game away in state court. And he may or may not represent the wishes at that time of Mr. Stanley. I have no way of making that kind of judgment. But, you know, given the record that was created in this case, that Stanley said, I want to be found competent, and decided, and waives, apparently knowingly, and it appears to be voluntarily, that right. If you go straight back into federal court, if the state waives the exhaustion question, the federal court may not have any recourse but to say, okay, I've got a judgment from the state court, and Mr. Stanley waived this, and let's move on.
Well,
what I'm suggesting is it may be strategic for you to try to get back into state court and have the state courts tell you that you don't have an exhaustion remedy, because you can then raise the cause and prejudice claim.
The strategy in this case has been extremely complicated to figure out for the last 16 years. That is certainly a consideration, Your Honor, and I appreciate Your Honor's comments on that. And they are serious comments. There's another side to that as well, and we might decide our strategy lies elsewhere. But some of these are very, very difficult calls. It is indeed possible that the state may say all the claims are defaulted, or they might just deny it on the merits. I don't think we're going to get any relief. Petitioners rarely do in the California Supreme Court, but it's a theoretical possibility. I realize the train has sort of left the station on a lot of these things, and I will sit down if the court likes. There were a couple of points about the hearing and the initial part of Mr. Witt's presentation that I would like to address very briefly.
Give us a hint as to what it is, and we'll see whether we think it's relevant. Go.
Well, the hesitation in my voice is I think some of them are a little bit tangential. Whether the hearing was meaningful or not, that's actually what we would like to litigate. So
that's,
I think
that's off to one side, and that's what's in front of us now.
A lot of argument about that would not be fruitful. Whether Mr. Stanley never wanted to be found incompetent, he has actually filed quite a number of letters claiming he is incompetent. So it's not true that he never wanted to be found.
And he may be incompetent to say that he's incompetent.
Or competent.
Correct. But he has a desire about that fluctuates. Yes. It's not consistent.
We're well aware of that.
I mean, Mr. Sessions, the one thing I want to say to you, and I think I speak for my colleagues, we understand the difficulty of representing a client like Stanley. I mean, this is a very, very unusual case. And without making any comment at all upon, you know, all these claims that Stanley has made about the representation, I've been very impressed with the work that you have done on this case. I think, having been a criminal defense lawyer myself, this is a tough case to handle.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I also will confess that is usually what a court says before they announce that we lose.
Well,
I do appreciate
if I was confident in the result, I wouldn't have said it. Because that may be a comment on the quality of your advocacy. This is a very, very tricky procedural mess. And I don't know what the right answer is as I sit here right now.
Thank you, Your Honor. With that, I will sit down and not make some other irrelevant
point. Nice to see you.
Okay. Thank both counsel for their very helpful arguments here. Stanley v. Chappelle now submitted for decision. Well, submitted. We'll send out a mediation order, which, and I think you can dispose of it one way or the other fairly quickly, in the sense of you'll be contacted by the mediator. The mediator will determine whether or not something is really worthwhile mediating, and that can often be decided pretty fast. If both of you, after thinking about it, say mediation isn't going to work, just tell the mediator. We'll decide. I wish I knew what we would decide, but we'll decide whatever we're going to decide at that point. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.